and launching us on some fairly amazing adventures that just don't quite work out sometimes. We've had some disastrous trips at times because of some of my big ideas and my thoughts of how things possibly could work out. It started a long time ago as a younger person when we were living in Charters Towers in North Queensland. And one day we had the great idea that we would walk to Townsville, a group of us. I was chaplain and teaching in a school, and there was a bit of a group of young people that were coming, or you know, young teachers that were coming to our church, and we decided that this is what we would do. It was a stupid idea. Charters Towers to Townsville is sort of like Toowoomba to Brisbane, probably about the same length, same distance. But like most stupid ideas, it started out feeling like a good idea. Well, not like most, but it started out feeling pretty good, because we all got together and there's a big group of us, and you know, we were saying, "Oh, this will be fun," and there's people around us saying, "Oh, you know, good on yous," and you know, a bit of bravado and a bit of encouragement. And we got to the edge of Charters Towers, and there's a big group of us walking together, and we're still feeling good because there's people in town driving past, and we're waving, and you know, because we're raising money for World Vision, and we're feeling really good about ourselves because we're a bit of a novelty in the town, because we're largely a group of Christians, but also we're doing something a bit out of the ordinary for a larger group of Christians. We got to a bridge that was about 25 kilometres out of town, and we'd left on a Friday afternoon, and we got to the bridge and it was quite dark, but there was a few people, and you know, we were still feeling good, waving and laughing, and you know, like, and thinking this is going to be great. And then we had about 4 hours sleep, if we're lucky, probably 3 hours if I was really honest, sleep. And yeah, after 3 hours sleep and waking up after a 25-kilometre walk the night before, without a lot of preparation, I must admit, I wasn't that fit. Some of the other people were fitter. I wasn't feeling so good. But anyhow, we walked for most of that day, and we got more and more tired and sore and aching. And I can still remember the pain today of when we would stop for a rest. Stopping for a rest was actually bad in the end, because when you tried to start again, I've never had such pain, not just in my muscles, but in my bones. My bones just ached. And it would take about half an hour of walking to try and become numb to that pain. I don't think the pain went away, you just became numb to it. So the aim was to walk to Townsville. But we got to a place called Calcium, which is about 85 kilometres out of Charters Towers. And we met some people from Charters Towers at that service station, because a lot of people stopped there. And I wasn't feeling so good. And I actually asked if someone would take me home. So I didn't actually ever make it to Townsville, walking at least. The only thing I wanted at that stage was to go home. Every part of me ached. And when I arrived home and there was no one home, and for once the door was locked. So I just laid down on the back step and and when April and a friend who was boarding with us arrived home, they just laughed. because my feet were huge, swollen, and because I didn't have proper shoes either, like just stupid, you know, like didn't prepare properly. But I'll never forget the ache. It was just an all-over body ache. And it wasn't just, you know, a slight muscular twinge. It just went to my bones. And I remember trying to walk into church the next day, and I couldn't actually walk properly. I was leaning on April, and I had to put my feet up, and it was a source of a lot of laughter for some people. I think, though, when you experience that level of ache, you sort of understand something of the ache that we all have living in this world. There's always, I think if we're really serious about thinking about our life, there's this deeper ache, you know, that there must be something more than this. We use the word sometimes yearning, something that comes from the very core of who we are. C.S. Lewis once said that if I find in myself a desire that no experience in this world can satisfy, then the probable explanation is that I was made for another world. It's a beautiful quote, that one, isn't it? It sort of explains that hunger, that thirst, that yearning that the psalmist so often talks about. We ache because God has designed us for perfection. We ache because in this life, we experience and we glimpse what God has in store for us for all eternity. We ache because God has given us a picture through His Son Jesus Christ of what life will be like when we stop aching. When you look at worship in the Old Testament, a lot of it centered around worship in the temple, especially in the Old Testament. And we see that Jesus also participated in worship in the temple and in the synagogue. But Jesus always maintained that true worship is something that starts from our hearts. And it's always about the direction of our attention, the direction of our attention. It's about how our hearts are centered on God. In the scriptures, and as we go into the New Testament, we see that a lot of attention in that culture, in the Jewish culture, was towards the correct posture, the correct behavior. And we see that in the synagogue services, for example, there were things like reading of scripture, there was praise. And as we come to the New Testament, we see that they become extremely particular about the form of worship, about whether you got things in their correct order, and whether you said the correct words, and whether you did the right things at certain times in the service. But Jesus cracked all that open. And this was extremely threatening for the people of his time. Because he said, you don't worship at this place or this place when you truly worship God. That's not how you truly worship God. You worship God in spirit and in truth. In spirit and in truth. From here and the way in which you live. Because Jesus' understanding of truth was always that it was a live truth. It wasn't just a whole bundle of knowledge that you had up here, a whole heap of theology or whatnot. It was in the way that you lived your life that truth was revealed to the world. And it's still true today. Secondly, wandering hearts. Two of the hugest influences in our world in the last century were one in the field of psychology was a guy called Sigmund Freud, and the other person in terms of community or society was a guy called Karl Marx. Interesting, they both had similar backgrounds or similar ethnic backgrounds. Both of them debunked Christianity largely on the basis on what they saw as the behaviour of the church. They debunked Christianity because they saw in the church, and this is their observation, that the church failed to have God in his proper place. And often when we understand worship, a lot of what we talk about worship, even in the church today, is man-centric. When worship truly is about being God-centric. When we come to the scriptures again, we see over and over again in the Old Testament, as we trace our way through it, in the Old Testament, that the worship of idols was condemned by the prophets over and over again. Jeremiah debunked the user-friendly gods. The God that we introduce into our world because we want to be in control. When we create user-friendly gods, we really are creating God in our own image. Over and over and over, the cry of the people of Israel as they saw the other gods of the other nations around them was, we don't want to miss out. It looks better what they've got than what we've got. Why can't we be like everyone else? And after a while, as these gods became introduced into their world, they became just like everyone else. And there's a warning here for the church this morning as well, that we are not able, we cannot, as the church today, allow ourselves to create God in our image. And we have all sorts of subtle ways of doing that in the church. Because the problem when we allow ourselves just to create God, just to allow ourselves, us to mold God, is that we become just like everyone else. And there's nothing that differentiates us from the rest of the world, except perhaps that we turn up for a Sunday morning service. The call to the church today is to be holy. And by that I don't mean walking around with some constructed halo around our head. But it's about a group of people who are committed to worshiping God in spirit and in truth. Jeremiah said, like a scarecrow in a melon patch, their idols cannot speak. They must be carried because they do not walk. Do not fear them because they can do no harm, nor can they do any good. His point was that they were trying to make God or their God too small by going to these other idols. And the same is true for us today. J.B. Phillips, who wrote a translation of the New Testament, wrote another little gem of a book called Your God is Too Small. Your God is Too Small. And it's brilliant because what he does is he describes the way in which we reduce God to something that we can contain within our own head. We reduce God to a box, a set of behaviors that we can understand and we can control and doesn't threaten our spirituality, doesn't threaten our everyday life, because, you know, we can just be like everyone else then. You know, we can do the things that we want to do because God's in this box here. This is where he belongs. We need to be careful today that we don't produce for the church and our church a user-friendly God. Because the God of the universe, who loves us with a deep intensity, is not content with a wandering heart. The God of the universe whom we worship wants a completely one-eyed faith. He wants our complete trust. He doesn't want a church that, you know, wants to have a two-way bet. It's foot in either camp. Oh, okay, we're going to worship God. We're going to follow him with all our hearts. But I want my career. Or I want to be able to have this financial comfort. Jeremiah, when he spoke, when he prophesied, was saying that the God that you want to worship is the one that you have under your control, and that's not the God of the universe who is speaking to you today. He was pointing out the stupidity of creating a God in our own image, because when we do that, all we do is end up worshipping ourselves, don't we? We need to be careful that we don't produce a God who we think we can appease by just doing the right things. When Jesus Christ chose to walk and live amongst us, his life and truth was the ultimate challenge to a history of idolatry, whether it be through the adoption of other gods of the nations around them in the nation of Israel, or whether it was this legalistic obsession with this narrow set of rules and guidelines that they said you had to live under. That was a form of idolatry as well. Jesus' life was showing humanity that we can't control God, that we are dependent on God's revelation to us for us to understand God. In Jesus' life, we see a person who put nearly everyone he met, and especially the religious people of his day, he put them off balance. We see it with his disciples over and over again, you know, like just the wonder in which they saw Jesus acting and some of the things that he did. We see it with the questions of people like Nicodemus, or of the Pharisees and Sadducees and the other religious people of the day. Jesus was the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, but he wasn't a God who was too distant to notice us, to hear our yearnings, to see our deep ache, to bring to us truth and also our daily bread. Idols are deceptive, they are destructive, they are self-serving, they are the exact opposite to who Jesus is. Jesus is the truth. His ministry was one of undeception. I think I just made that word up. He was the good shepherd who gave up his life for his sheep. In Jesus, all the fullness of God lived. Finally, learning to adore God. What comes into our minds when we think about God is perhaps the most important thing about us. The history of mankind has shown pretty much that no nation has ever risen above its religion. And man's spiritual history will probably show that no religion has ever risen above its concept of God. Here is our God. I am the Lord your God. Be still and know that I am God. From the cloud there came a voice that said, "This is my Son, the Beloved. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces, overcome with fear. They left all and followed him. In each of these scripture passages, we hear and see and feel both adoration and abandonment. We have what happens when worship really occurs, a total giving of ourselves. An acknowledgement of God's glory. And in our world today, that's a really hard place to come to, because we live in the world of the amazing, don't we? Every day there are new amazing things happening. You look at, you know, things like Facebook and, you know, or there's always something amazing, incredible that's being launched. Or I just think of some of the incredible inventions that we've done. You know, huge glass bridges in China, and you know, I saw the other day this amazing garden bed that actually, you know, makes even a failed gardener like myself successful. That's incredible. Amazing photos. You know, we live in a world where this is shared, and every day is an awe-inspiring day with sunsets and sunrises and sunsets, and we live in a world where we can adore and worship many things. But there needs to be something also in our lives that creates a space where we can adore and worship God. Because that adoration and that worship is the very core of who we are. One famous theologian said, "Who is the man who trembles before God? Who is the man who trembles before God?" If we're really going to discover worship, we have to be people who can discover God. And we discover God by having no other idols in our life. We discover God by being completely one-eyed. By learning, and I use the word learning intentionally, by learning to attend to Him first. Not second, not third, not as an add-on, but by attending to God first. We need to do this so we can discover something of the awe and wonder of who God is again. When the disciples saw things that Jesus did, here's some of the words that the Gospels say. When they saw the daughter of Jairus raised from death, they were overcome with astonishment. When they saw Jesus walking on the water, they were completely and utterly dumbfounded. When they saw the paralytic cured, they said, "We have never seen anything like this." Is that our experience of God? It can be. And I'm not just talking about spectacular signs and wonders, although that's incredible when it happens. I'm talking about the sheer wonder that comes from knowing that I belong to the infinite Creator God. There's a wonder in that. That the infinite Creator God calls me Chris Gribble, His beloved son. The beloved. Is there anything better than that? And yet, we still will chase after these trinkets on the side. And rather than being the add-ons, too often they become the center. What does our heart really yearn for as a church? It's really easy in church life to lose focus. It's easy to point out where things could be improved, and look, that's all a necessary part of church life as well. It's easy in church life to focus on things like real estate or on personalities or the big one, my personal preference. The danger when they take center stage, when those things take center stage, is that gradually we start serving those things until they begin to take over and they become our idols. And gradually what can happen is we start serving those things and we forget. And we forget. And we forget about God. And we forget about the stuff that really matters. In Him we live and breathe and have our being. Let's, as a church, worship God in spirit and in truth.